the other day for that.
You work for, oh, this is a friend of Peter's, tape 3, June 27th, 1997. You worked 20 years in an OR operating rooms after you were in Laos. And I mentioned earlier that I'm interested just in the experience of nurses in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam era. And I think I have to raise my voice over the monsoon. My God, thank God there's no Tyrannosaurus Rex out there in the Kauai rainforest coming after us.
But we have these big green frogs.
Yes, I'll bet you they're pretty threatening. No teeth, but they're pretty threatening. The question I wanted to ask was that a lot of nurses who served in Southeast Asia chose to work in emergency rooms deliberately, because there they had the responsibility and the autonomy that they had in Vietnam in particular. Well, that was the only place there were large numbers of
units. And
operating rooms are like that too. Did you ever have a feeling that when you got back to Oregon that somehow you felt at home because of the experience you had in Laos? The camaraderie, I'm sorry, when you got back to Oregon, when you started working in the OR, did it make you feel like you were building on an experience that you'd had before?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. But the OR did give you that strength and that feeling that you were, you weren't just one dumb floor nurse, if that's what you mean. Saying, yes, doctor, no, oh, of course, doctor, may I get this for you, doctor? In the OR, the doctor would say, you know, such and such an instrument, stat, and, you know, you whack it into his hand really hard if he was being rude to you. You know, you still had that little bit of control. But I think things that happened after that, and with an injury and stress and negative relationships and the Gulf War thing, then kind of brought a lot back too, but not to the head that it did here. All those things, the experiences in Laos affected that a lot. And, you know, whether it was still wondering if someone's listening, you know, through your walls or whatever, but you lost that sense of knowing who you were. And just this last year, I went to the guy who does the VA counseling here, because mm-hmm. they have a post-traumatic stress group therapy. Mm-hmm. And when I asked, I told him I worked in Northern Laos, and, you know, I was taking care of all war-related injuries, but I asked him if I could come to the group. And he was at first saying, well, I think so. And then he checked and he said, oh, no, you were a civilian? And I said, yeah. And he said, we haven't had a civilian allowed to be treated by the VA since the March on Bataan by an act of Congress. So he found out that, no, he couldn't. He couldn't let me come. Now is that, yeah.
Is that wacko? How many civilians have combat-related post-traumatic stress disorder that would qualify truly as civilians as opposed to veterans?
But one of the guys I've been volunteering with at the museum up here in the mountains, he told me just last week that he sees no reason why I couldn't come. And he actually is quite active in the group, and he was going to see if I could come.
I think that'd be great. There actually is, by the way, a post-traumatic stress disorder clinic in Washington, D.C. for women, only for women. But it's mostly for women nurses. Was opened about maybe 7 years ago, which is amazing when you think you have 5,000 nurses who served in Vietnam, more in civilian capacities as well. And that was the first time they ever decided to start thinking about that. That's a lot of weight to carry for a long, long time. Well, you mentioned a book that you handed to me. I want to just read it into the tape. It's called I Can't Get Over It, A Handbook for Trauma Survivors by Aphrodite Matsakis, Matsakis, PhD, a specialist in post-traumatic stress disorder. And there she is. And it's published by New Harbinger Publications. And the date is
There's a whole section on Vietnam.
1992.
War-related. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's car accidents and everything else, too. I mean, any major event.
Well, according to, I've done a study of homelessness and its relationship to PTSD, as you can imagine, quite obviously, there's a tremendous connection between having any psychological disorder and its relationship to homelessness. But amongst those things are the time in which any treatment is received and the time of the stress. That seems to be the most important. But Arthur Barham, who is head of a VA counseling job, the Labor Department had the first vet centers, mm-hmm. oddly enough, not the VA. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that everybody has post-traumatic stress. Everybody does not have post-traumatic stress disorder. So we all carry around with us a trauma which can inhibit our responses and shape behavior, but it doesn't become chronic and become interfering with the quote normal process of your life in everyone. So we all have those things, and they're very painful, and they're as prevalent. That's I noticed right away. First thing I look for is men can be raped, and that really bad things can happen. And if you pretend that they can't or they didn't happen to you, then you're damaging yourself. So I'm rambling here. I'm really tired. But anyway, that rape victims, in other words, there's a big whole thing in gender studies whether rape victims are the same as victims of combat trauma. And of course, people in the military really don't want to hear that. Whatever we have is ours. And by the way, none of us are crazy. You know, it's a
defensive.
Yeah, yes. Deep denial isn't just a river in Egypt. Yes, that kind of thing.
Well, I've been accused of being very defensive, mm-hmm. in many situations, and I think, you know, I always say, "Well, not me."
But we were talking generally earlier, before we started the tape. And how, was that after Aniki that you found yourself at the aquarium calling your friend?
No, it was about 3 months after Aniki. Just the working 12 hours on, 12 hours off, 7 days a week, taking cold showers, washing my clothes, stomping on them in the shower, cooking on a one burner propane camp stove for meals. I could have eaten, I would always eat breakfast at the hospital, because that was, you know, like you'd get up early and you'd go over there and they only allowed you one meal a day served there. Of course, I never thought that I was anyone who needed those Red Cross meals. It was like, oh no, that's for the people who lost their house. And actually, I mean, I should have gone. I went like maybe once in 3 months, because it was, and that was typical of Kauai though in general, is everyone was saying, oh no, I don't need it, I'm okay. And so for months, everyone's going, I don't need it, I'm okay. You know, they're up on their roof for, you know, 48 hours trying to keep everything from leaking, and somebody offers them food and they go, oh no, I'm okay. People would, you know, get dehydrated. We had people hallucinating because they were so dehydrated, but they were like, oh no, I'm okay. Everyone was okay, you know, and everyone was being so strong. It was like, well, I'm strong too. I can do anything. I can work 24 hours a day and never sleep and not eat, and I'm fine. I'm washing my clothes in the shower. And then all of a sudden it hits you. And I just, I said, I gotta go somewhere. So I went to Honolulu for the weekend. And on the plane over, I ran into a guy who was a friend of mine. I didn't actually know him. But so he offered me a ride. And he said, where are you going? And I said, I don't know. And he said he was going to Waikiki area. Did I want a ride? And I said, oh, okay, you can drop me off at the zoo. Dropped me off at the zoo, and I had a backpack with me for the weekend, and there was no place to check it at the zoo, and they wouldn't let me leave it at the counter because they didn't want to be responsible for it. So I couldn't go into the zoo, and I was all bummed. I just wanted to go look at the animals. Anyway, so I walked to a payphone and called this lady who had first picked me up when I got off the plane, and she took one look at me, and I forgot that she was a mental health nurse. Expert. She you know, gives test. Well, what do you call it? At trials and things.
Expert witness.
Yeah, mm-hmm. She's the expert witness. So, totally forgot she was a mental health nurse, but she took one look at me and she was like going, sleep deprivation. You're not eating properly. You're not. She made me lay down and sleep, and I slept straight 5 hours. And I looked out of the window. She's on like this 40th floor on some high rise. And I looked out the window, and the first thing I noticed was that there were no blue tarps anywhere. Mm-hmm. Kauai was just blue tarps everywhere. And as I walked to this place we went to eat, I noticed there were no smashed windshields. Kauai had smashed windshields everywhere. And it was like one of those, you know, like you're in Laos and you're seeing dead bodies blown up, and then 2 minutes later you're in Bangkok watching some, you know, you're walking through a Wat seeing these beautiful gold painted statues. No, what do you call that? Doesn't go together.
No separation.
And it's just like you were there, and then you were there, and then you're back there, and you're doing all you can do, and then you're over there having a party and drinking, what was that rice whiskey stuff? They made it out of rice. Lau Lau. Burns with a blue flame. And you could not refuse it. That was rude. And then if you drank it, you kind of went from sober to sick, but you were, you know. That was the tradition, right? And so, you know, you'd party hard, and the next day you'd be, you know, doing surgery to save some guy's leg. And then the next day you're in Vientiane at a party with some ambassador. And the next day you're out with seeing blown off arms and legs again. I mean, nothing went together. And I think Aniki brought it all back. It was all of a sudden, everything was fine. It was this beautiful little green island, and all of a sudden, all the trees were brown from the winds whipping them so hard, it ripped the bark off. It looked like napalm. This island looked like it had been napalmed. It was scorched, it was burned, it was dead. People were coming in left and right with all kinds of injuries from their houses. Even if it didn't happen during the hurricane, once they went back to start fixing their houses, the roof would fall in on them and all kinds of stuff.
You mentioned something that maybe you even mentioned at the beginning, that you were pulling shrapnel-like objects out of people's flesh from the hurricane that had driven in by the high winds.
Well, a lot of it wasn't from the being out in the winds. It was like they were hiding in a closet, mm-hmm. and the wind would take the whole roof off, mm-hmm. and boards would come crashing down and they'd get splinters right. That way or something. You know, it wasn't like they were out
driven
in it, but...
Yeah. Did you ever make any associations with Laotians that you brought back with you or tried to keep in contact with? Or Hmong?
Chua and Chulo were the mm-hmm. only two, and I lost contact with them for a while, and then I heard they were in Minnesota, and then I heard and I never really contacted Minnesota, mm-hmm. but I heard she died of breast cancer. Mm. But she was probably...
Chua or Chualo?
Chua.
Chua.
And I think, I don't remember how old she was, but I know she was young. Well, I think she was older than me at that time, and I was in my early 20s.
Well, I think that brings to an end, almost, our conversation. One person said after we talked for like 2.5 hours, hey, we didn't even talk about the important bits. And I said, well, I'll come back. And I can, because he lives in the LA area, so it's no problem.
You can't come back here, it's too far.
Yeah, but I can always talk to you on the phone.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But the thing is there something that you think, that you know, going over your notes and all
well,
that?
Well, I made notes and I can't even find them, so I don't
know. Well, tomorrow night, you know, we could sit down. We'll just stop the tape here. And tomorrow night, well, if you could find the notes, well, we can, you know, we spend a half hour.
Well, like the North Vietnamese prisoner, I wanted to be sure and tell that one.
Yeah.
Also, I saw a man die of tetanus, lockjaw, mm-hmm. and that was unbelievable. And never in my life do I ever hope to see that ever again. Just the slightest touch of a window or a door, and he would set off seizures and convulsions. Oh, it was awful. Things like that, you know, it was like, I never thought about it for years and years and years and years and years. And then one day somebody made a comment about Lockjaw, and I just pictured that man in my mind, and the pain and the misery, and we couldn't, I mean, narcotics didn't even touch it. That kind of stuff, you know. But,
let's see if we can maybe come back tomorrow night and see if there's something that we missed.
Thank you.
TV.
We can talk about, well, that.
No, meeting. No.
Go ahead. No, just read that note.
Oh.
Out.
Just asked me if I knew anything about an IBS meeting, and I said no. Right here is IBS annual meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you meant?
Yeah. Was anything discussed then? Though?
General meeting at 7:30 to 8 a.m.
What
then
day?
Us four nurses got together in love and gave us the news that no more IBS nurses were being recruited. Only one slot was to remain after all of us leave, and that's Sam Tong. Sue Robbins, I don't even remember who Sue Robbins was really mad. And very rudely called Bob a patsy and told him he ought to move back to the USAID compound. Didn't go to any more wasted meetings today. How's that for an answer? That's why I didn't know about him. I didn't go. Practiced for the talent show and walked to Utah's. Gary making stereotapes. Saw the forgotten war in Laos at 7:30. Was that a movie? In 68? Went to bed early. Next day, went to the first few meetings, but skipped out on Mendenhall. Didn't miss much, I'm sure. Sang with Murdoch and had fun singing again. Practiced with John and Larry Olson. A Lao song, but I didn't sound so well. Oh, whatever happened to Larry Olson? Did you interview him?
He might be on the list. I don't have it with me. Oh, I haven't interviewed him.
He was an awesome Lao-speaking person. Native-sounding, I mean, even.
John?
Larry Olson.
Larry Olson. Okay, I'll check.
Banquet IBSers at ACA, good food, quite a talent show, went to 1 a.m. Jerry Lewis, IBS songs, a skit on international mandatory service, then some went to Candia's for the rest of the night, and smoked pot. Do you want that on there?
Sure.
Then Gary went golfing the next day with Larry Woodson, Jim and Dick S., whoever that is, at Dong Dok. I stayed in bed. We talked about French and anthropology. Oh my goodness. Oh, here we go. Laverne College reunion. Ron and June, Karen and Ivan, Rick and us had a good Chinese dinner at the Tan Dao Vien, then sat around and talked about old times. Ron was hung up on sex and death. June wanted to hear more rumors to add to her collection. Right here in black and white. Oh, here's Harley and Charlene Schwadron, left IBS in the country with very little warning, just told love and they were gone. That was February 68. So I guess there was an IBS meeting.
You just didn't go to the one that mattered.
I didn't go to
that. Yeah.
Oh, here's what I did one day in Sam Tong, you want this?
Mm-hmm.
Didn't go on rounds all the way, made sample med box, ward 3, cleaned it up again, amputated foot on a leprosy patient, class at 10, D was busy cleaning out the ER, taught capital A, printed, capital A, cursive, capital B, just so they can read the writing. I taught them, let's see, I asked Chua to explain, everyone writes a little different, you know, like cursive, yeah. Dr. K, Dr. T, and myself will not all look alike. They seemed to enjoy the class. One girl got to snuffling. Everyone was giggling. 11 o'clock, made my own rounds, put a few people in better position, and cleaned them up. About noon, home, took a shower, did a little laundry, washed dishes, packed my bag, grabbed a bite to eat, and then left for 20A, which is Longcheng. So I went up to the office and waited for a ride to Vientiane. Couldn't contact Lauren F. Was that Finn? Finnell? I think he was IVS, yeah. Mm-hmm. Got here about 3 and went straight to IVS office. Went to get the mail. Got a room at IVS house. Took Ann's mail to Building A. Safe hands, in quotes. So I guess I was a courier and didn't know it, too. Mm-hmm. And something to cashier and paid a dollar bill. Got zip code for courthouse address APO. Back to IVS. Wrote a few letters. 5:30 to ACA. Had watermelon and barbecued spare ribs with Mac Thompson, Bob Wiederhold, Larry Woodson, Lauren Finnell, and Bernie Wilder. I don't even remember half those names. Mm-hmm. By 7, back in my room, looked at the new Sears catalog, wrote a long letter to Art and Agnes, and went to bed at 9:30.
Art and Agnes
was Gary's parents.
Okay.
There is one day.
I know. That's what I thought was neat.
That was like from amputating a foot to...
writing the letter home.
The watermelon and barbecued spare ribs with all, you know. Woo. There we go. I brought the vaccine here, it looks like. Oral polio vaccine. Back to the medical warehouse. Doesn't say where, though. I don't know where it was. Bought vaccine straight to IVS house freezer.
You know, as long as we're here, during the Gulf War, you were actively opposed to the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
Did, you know, we talked about how, a lot about how in Laos the war just seemed to be another thing, you know, another realm of the madness that was just living in Laos.
That's why we kept saying, didn't we learn anything? I was more active against the Nicaraguan thing than mm-hmm. I was the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any of that activity? Or how your Laotian experience applied to Nicaragua?
I think because once I did, after all those years, realize what went on in Laos, I'm thinking, it was all so stupid and lives were so wasted. Why are we doing this crap again?
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you mean, crap?
We blew up a lot of people. The Sandinista-Contra thing, the... You know,
Let's go back to Laos. What did we do in Laos that you... in retrospect, saw as being not right or meaningless?
Well, I think one of my eye-openers was the 12 guys on a hilltop mm-hmm. who were put there by the U.S. military to intervene and intercept information. They were not protected, and they shouldn't have been there anyway by, you know, all the standards of the secret war thing, what's going on up there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first of all, they probably shouldn't have been where they were.
Mm-hmm.
Then the fact that they were not protected, mm-hmm. and then the fact that they all died because Mr. You-Know-Who in the U.S. Embassy said, oh no, we can't do this, this, and this, because then the world might find out that we're there, and then if we do something major like drop napalm in those little caves and blow up those North Vietnamese guys, somebody will find out about it, and then we've broken the treaty of this, you know, whatever we're mm-hmm. not doing that we're doing. I mean, so they didn't do that, and the guys scaled the rock walls and killed them all.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's so stupid. So what do? We go to the Gulf, and we start blowing up Saddam Hussein as our evil madman who's just another, you know, reason to have our military machine.
Mm-hmm.
And they make him this great big evil person that we can't touch. Of course, we can do everything else in the world, but we can't touch him, right? But we keep up this going. And then we kill a whole bunch of guys from our own friendly fire. We blow up my gas fields or whatever they are, oil. We burn, make this disaster of the environment. Of course, George Bush's son still has his little island full of oil that now he can protect because we made sure of that. If I sound cynical,
paranoid. but go back to Nicaragua though.
Okay. June's cousin.
Mm-hmm. June's cousin, Nicaragua.
Was in Nicaragua.
June's cousin was in Nicaragua, right?
And most of the information that I really know about Nicaragua, mm-hmm. I heard from Ralph. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it also then, you know, came out more underground information, mm-hmm. too. And it's the one I joined that I really was watched. I gave money to some underground, you know, where they were hiding people. Mm-hmm. What's that called?
An underground railroad?
CISPUS? Central American... Yeah, it was like an underground railroad to get people that were, you know, involved in Central America that would have been killed if they stayed there. So they, like El Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua, all of those areas.
Well, actually, my question runs in a different way.
Okay.
When did you begin to feel that America should not have been in Laos?
It's probably, God, I don't know if I can put a date on it.
Just vaguely.
I would venture to say it wasn't until my kids were more into junior high, probably. Yeah. And once I felt that there was a reason, I didn't want them ever to be involved in something like that. I didn't want them to ever have to go.
And what did you think was wrong?
We're always mucking up places where we don't belong. You
okay.
know that?
Yeah, that's pretty good. And, well, what about stopping international communism? Isn't that worth the effort?
The whole communism thing never really meant anything to me. Even in high school, I had a teacher by the name of Virginia Franklin, if you remember, front page of Life magazine in the early 60s, like 61, 62, somewhere in there. Or no, it was right after I graduated, so it must have been 63. She would teach things like, if America is apple pie and baseball, and you only like soccer and carrot cake, does that make you communist?
It certainly does.
She was an awesome person who made people think, uh-huh. who put things in perspective. Mm-hmm. Of course, the John Birchers called her a communist.
How did she end up on the cover of Life magazine?
Because a John Bircher's son mm-hmm. audio taped her classroom lectures, spliced it out of context, and tried to pass it off saying she was teaching communism to get her fired. She was very liberal, but she was very, very smart.
What happened?
She lost her job there and went to Berkeley and taught at Berkeley for many years after that and finally retired.
In the school system or at UC?
I think at the university in Berkeley. Oh. Yeah. She was an awesome teacher. And I think from even that experience, that was way before I went to Laos, mm-hmm. a lot of things, when people talked about communism, I'd go, so what is it, you know? What is communism?
Cynical.
What is it? Is it anything I should be afraid of? Or is it something that someone has created to make it sound like I should be afraid of? Or is it such a nebulous, unbelievable, we don't know what it is, but we're going to make it big so we can go shoot at it? So the word communism, I never thought of it as being something I had to go out and do anything about.
So you didn't go to Laos to help stop the spread of communism? Well, see, we did get to an important point there.
No, I think basically we went because it fulfilled Gary's CO status, for one, mm-hmm. and I wanted to experience a third world for my, you know, like my training. I really, public health was what I wanted to go into, mm-hmm. And I never really did that until just now. last year.
In a tropical climate.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it worked out after all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Took me a long time.
Took you a long time. Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay.
That's great.
Thanks.
Well, let's go.
Soft as
yes.
well.
Yes. Oh. One thing I didn't ask you, what was your birthday?
8-14-44.
1848.
August 14-44.
Thank you. How do you spell August? A-U...
Okay.
All right. We're ready.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, you were going to tell me about the storytellers.
The Mulam singers?
Yes. How do you spell that?
I have no idea.
Take a shot.
Probably Moulam or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Mulam, yeah. Mm-hmm. They were in the villages when we were just beginning out. I don't think we'd even gone to Sam Tong yet, but we were finished with language training, and I don't even remember where we were. But I remember that they were singing kind of like the news, and they would go from village to village bringing the news of what was going on. Whether it was war-related news or just, you know, gossip of who was going to marry who, I don't have a clue either. But the funniest part, I thought, was there were moments where even the old ladies were just laughing raucously. And so we turned to the fellow who was like an interpreter, and we'd catch words here and there, but we didn't have the gist of the whole, you know, statement. And that's when I first realized that in Laos, you know, all these sweet, demure little farm ladies weren't just sweet little demure farm ladies, they were real. And I asked him, why are they laughing so loud? And he turned, he wouldn't tell me, but he told Gary. He said, they said that her nipples were the color of the old lady's butthole. And everyone thought that was the funniest thing. And we were like, of course, still pretty young and naive, I think, and we were kind of shocked that they would say something like that. And from that moment on, though, everything kind of was in the village level. You realize people really were down to earth. And everyone was so friendly and so wonderful, and in so many ways, you know, it didn't matter what their politics, didn't matter at all.
You mentioned something about you knew one of the nurses that worked with Tom Dooley.
No, I only met her. I didn't really know her very well.
Uh-huh.
But she kind of, you know, told me what, because she knew I was a nurse. And I met her in the embassy in Vientiane. And I think we kind of just visited once, like at a lunch or something.
Mm-hmm.
But she was telling us all the things that how much fun it was to work for Tom Dooley, because he didn't care about this and didn't care about that, and they did whatever they wanted. And she was a stewardess who, like, she, that was her volunteer then thing, to be the nurse for him, one of some, I don't even know where.
She was a flight attendant who volunteered to be a nurse?
Well, she was a nurse.
Uh-huh.
As well.
Uh-huh.
And she worked as a stewardess.
Uh-huh.
And she, I don't know, she just flew all over the place.
Uh-huh.
And she had just been in Turkey, I think, before she came there to Laos. She was kind of an interesting person, and I'm not really sure I believed a lot of the things she told me. And she seemed like a rather loose woman.
Loose? Fast?
Well, I didn't know too many in those days.
Uh-huh.
Oh. But I didn't know too much about the Tom Dooley thing at all. That I met her that one time.
And I think you mentioned that occasionally these, actually we got off on the White Rose, but do you remember any of the other kind of celebrity or policymakers that came through that you ever caught a glimpse of?
I never met him, but I heard Senator Young from Ohio was there. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, but beyond Senator Young. Yeah.
Oh, there were people from Time and Life and National Geographic, and there was always somebody coming to Sam Tong and interviewing Pop and writing articles about Laos, and none of them ever interviewed me.
Right.
I know in the hospital, I was slaving away the day the National Geographic guy came in, and we had a daughter of an embassy person who was still in her first year of nurses training, and she was up there for the summer just, you know, kind of helping out or doing whatever she was doing, and she was always looking very cute, and they took pictures of her. And in the National Geographic, gosh, I can't remember now, it must have been in 68 or so, there's a picture of her as the nurse at Sam Tong, so I was a little, like, not thrilled. But
you were some woman.
Yeah, I was the some woman doing all the work. And she got the glory. Isn't that the way it always works? There's always one. But sad to say, I did find out from a friend of mine that she was brutally murdered not too long ago. It sounded really awful. She was this one the Army attaché. He had kept in touch with a lot of people, and he told me that she had like two children, and her husband shot them all. Isn't that awful?
You mean killed the whole family?
Yeah, yeah. I think they were somewhere, I don't know, Texas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, somewhere like that.
Something happened recently?
Oh, no. Probably been 5 or 10 years ago. Yeah. Yeah. Because I said, oh, I wonder what ever happened to Kathy Pollock, that was her name. Maybe you can find out what happened again.
Well, probably. Except then we'd be paying more attention to not the some other woman.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
Right, right.
What was the name of the Army attaché?
John McManus.
McManus. And
now, Dean Scroggins was there when we got there.
Uh-huh.
And then he got shipped from Laos to Alaska. And then McManus was there the rest of the time we were there.
Have you kept in touch with him since then?
Mm-hmm. John and his wife, Jeannie, used to write us Christmas cards every year, and we'd send them Christmas cards. And they had two girls. We had two girls. We kind of kept in touch all these years. And John's now in Bosnia. And
signed up for another year.
And signed up for another year. It was called Operation Joint Endeavor first. Now it's Operation Constant Guard, trying to equalize the Serbs and the... Is it the Croats? Is that what they are?
In different places, yeah. That's one part. Then there's Serbs and Bosnian Muslims somewhere else. Well, that's very interesting. You were talking about yesterday. Yesterday you said, you know, you don't ask me, what was the most fascinating this or what was the most interesting that? You can see how hard it is to ask that question without getting someone to laugh, you see. It's like saying, you've been in many cities, which was your favorite? You know, those don't go anywhere.
No.
But is there something that stands out that Gary and you did together?
No. Sorry. We didn't do a whole lot of things together. Uh-huh. He was always running around with chickens and ducks and pigs and over at the farm, and a lot of times he stayed out in the villages and I was alone. And then when I got moved out because the North Vietnamese were too close to us, about 2 kilometers away or whatever that was, then he stayed up in Sam Tong and I was in Vien Chan. So probably the most fun thing we did was when we took our little R&R and went to Pattaya Beach in southern Thailand for a week. And then once we did a little R&R to Hong Kong. But other than that, the rest of it was mostly pretty intense. And yet we were always like, well, this is what we're supposed to do. So it wasn't like we thought it was intense at the time. But afterwards, when we think about all that we did, you know, he was running around with a little radio, air to ground, with military types as well as USAID types. No one ever really, you know, questioning who anyone was. Well, General Vang Pao always called Gary doctor, just because I was the nurse. Even though he knew Gary wasn't a doctor, but it was like, you know, a doctor and a nurse should be together, right? So he always called him Doc. And Gary doesn't know anything medical and never wanted to know anything medical. But when he was out in the villages and doing all the agricultural work, I don't know what Vang Pao thought the heck he was doing.
Well, maybe thought he was a professor.
Yeah, or so... you know, like he was so in tune with what he was doing that Vang Pao probably never really noticed what Gary was doing, you know. Plus, that's kind of the way it was in Northern Laos. People didn't question what anyone did. Nobody questioned. When you got on a plane and you went to Udorn, nobody asked, who are you and what are you doing? Like anyone normally would do here. They'd say, why are you getting on this plane? Or where do you think you're going? Nobody ever asked that. If you got on a plane, you could get off the plane, and you could get right back on that plane the next day to go back to wherever you came from. And no one ever asked anyone anything. Of course, the North Vietnamese, Hanoi Hannah, mentioned our names on the radio. She knew where everyone was and what they were doing.
Your names in particular?
Oh, yeah, our names were mentioned.
In what context?
The nurse who was, you know, it was a propaganda thing. Mm-hmm. Somebody was listening all the time, I'm sure.
Right.
But I can't remember who told me. They heard my name saying the American, you know, monger or whatever, working in the hospital in Sam Tong. However, I was never worried about if I got captured, and which is probably totally naive and stupid, but I was never worried because I figured, okay, I'm a woman and I'm a nurse and I can work. So even if they captured me, I didn't think they'd beat me up and put me in a little box in the ground. I figured they'd put me to work. So I just, like, if I ever got captured, I always thought, okay, I can handle it. You know, I'll just keep on working. I don't know what they would have done with an American female if they ever did catch someone.
Well, that brings something up. I mean, surely you throw your hands up and say, but I'm a pacifist.
We never really talked about it. You know, uh-huh. You didn't say you were. Gary ran around for 2 years and never told anyone he was a CO. Mm-hmm. The fact that he was the only person who didn't carry a gun was probably fairly obvious, and yet nobody ever said anything, and he never said anything. He never told those guys that he was a CO. And everyone just figured we were these idealistic college students, you know, that had just decided to save the world, I guess. But we were pacifists. I mean, truly, we were, you know, trying to just to help out and do what we thought was a purpose of our, you know, our experience. We weren't there to argue about politics or who, you know, nothing about communism. We didn't even talk about communism. I don't think the word ever came up except as mentioned the Patat Lao were communists, you know.
But where did you think that idealism came from?
I think everybody in the early 60s had it, didn't they?
Yeah, but for example, your sister didn't get it.
Oh, well, my sister's a... You were going to bring up my sister. Mm-hmm. My sister and I came from two different molds. our whole lives, we were so opposite. I was the tomboy climbing trees. She was, you know, always reading books. She was quieter. I was noisy. I'm black. She's white. I'm leather and she's lace. I'm liberal, she's conservative. When she came here to visit me in Kauai, I took her to the military base for lunch and she was absolutely shocked. Her husband was in the Navy and she had thought I was so anti-military just because I had protested the Gulf War or whatever. You know, she knew about some of those things and being involved in CISPAS and Central American issues at one time. During the Nicaraguan thing, she was horrified that I would even go on a base. And I said, I'm real. I'm human. I have friends that work here. She was shocked. What else do I know about my sister? She's 6 years older. June knows her. She was summa cum laude.
At
Laverne College.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What was her name?
Beverly.
Oh, what's your maiden name?
Oh, God, I'm not putting that on tape. It is a mile long, and it is just the most disgusting name. I never want to ever hear it again.
We have ways of finding out.
You know how a lot of people yes. will make a mistake and write their old maiden name on a check after they've been married 10 years? Uh-huh. I never did that. Oh, all right. Butterbaugh.
Which is pronounced?
Well, if you're in German, it's Butterbach.
Butterbach.
But it's Butterbaugh if you're in California.
Oh, I see.
I hate that name. I was called Margarine Cube, Oleo Square, Butterball. Yes, you name it.
Uh-huh.
Turkey Time, yeah.
Yeah, we really needed that on the tape.
Oh, you needed that. Don't put that in the book.
No.
Okay.
We'll just write the former Ms.
Brenda Joy. There, you can have my middle name, but not my maiden name. Okay. Oh. When I lived in Nigeria, they tried to call me the Hausa word for joy, which was Bura. It was a Bura word for joy, Kucheli, and I always liked it.
Mm.
It even sounds kind of Hawaiian, don't you think, with the K?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I never used it. Maybe I ought to use that.
And I wanted to actually ask some dates to make sure we got some dates right. Let's see. Let me shut this off for a second. Okay, just to review some dates. You were born on...
August 14th, 1944.
And you, let's see, you joined IVS. You went to Harper's Ferry around...
Around August of 67.
And you arrived in... You left Vietnam. You left Laos around
August of '69, and we traveled from Bangkok to Burma to India to Nepal to Kenya to, we almost went to, oh, and we went to Uganda, we went to Nigeria and Ghana, and then we jumped to New York and to Seattle.
And then you were pregnant.
And we were home in December. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was pregnant. Yes, my clothes did not fit when I got home.
And, let's see, you left Oregon and moved to Kauai.
June of 92.
June of 92, and you've been living here since June of 92.
Right.
And let's see, you're employed as you're a case manager of a home health service.
Right, an RN case manager, coordinate the home care with the doctors, the physical therapist, the occupational therapist, the home health aide, kind of try to coordinate everything so that the patient gets taken care of.